They ask me why I'm made for why I'm bad. They tell me I've got things they never read. They tell me go to church and see the light, cause the good Lord's always right. So what? So what? So what?
How are you doing, Steve?
All right, how you doing?
Well, you're known for being generous with your time. It's something that's commonly said about you. So thanks a lot for being here.
Well, look, the way I always look at it, Dylan, if people have been bothered to, you know, go to one of my gigs on a rainy Wednesday night, or they've bothered to buy one of my records, at least I can give them 5 minutes of my time.
Well, I've been checking in on your social media and I see that your live dates have been moved about and rescheduled, much like everybody else's. But have you found social media to have been a useful tool for putting out a positive message and maintaining a sense of community over the last year or so?
Yeah, and that was a really important thing, Dylan, you know, that anything we put out was positive.
Yeah.
You know, that was really important. I mean, I did do one talking thing where I just said, look, you know, I'm having one of those down days and I'm sure everybody else is going through it, but look, we'll get through it and that kind of thing. So I was honest, you know, at the same time, because let's face it, it's not being all like, oh, this is great.
I think you got to be honest for people to believe the positivity, right?
You've got to, and I wasn't buying into that thing of like, oh, it's all a conspiracy and it's blah and this. Well, so what if it is? There's still people dying from it and I don't want to be one of them and I don't want my wife to be one of them. So, you know, shut up. leave all that till it's over.
So you're in Sea Pauling in Norfolk on the coast of England these days and you volunteered on the local lifeboat crew for a few years, but that came to an end recently?
Yes, that came to an end about five, 6 years ago, purely to age, because of age. And really being a lifeboat person, it really is for young people, you know, because when you're on a small boat like we were, well, even if you're on a bigger one, the battering that your back takes from, you know, bashing around on the waves is pretty severe.
Yeah.
And your reactions obviously aren't as quick as younger people. So you've really got to be on the ball. So before they said, Steve, we're standing you down and you'll be sweeping up in the boat shed, I was like, I think I'll call it quits and I'll be a fundraiser. Yeah. So because it's Dylan, every time I go down there, I just want to get out on the boat. You know, I never thought that would ever happen, you know, that I'd actually miss going out. You know, on a rough sea. I must be mad.
Well, that must have been nerve-wracking, but obviously pretty brave as well.
It was nerve-wracking, but at the same time exciting. I mean, you know, you suddenly realise, you know, the thing I like about it was that it took away all sense of ego. There was no ego. You didn't go out there on a shout, you know, thinking, look, what a brave person I am. I'm sleeping on a lifeboat. It's no... Yeah. Don't know what it is, but we're going out to it. Right, we're launching, we're out at sea, we're surrounded by green water. Let's get this job done, and that's it. You just do it.
And I saw that during your Last Supper tour of Crass songs that you brought the lifeboat crew up on stage.
Yeah, well, I wanted to do that because they, when I first joined, I mean, obviously I'd never been on a lifeboat before, and I used to find it quite amusing that they would take me out on training in very, very lumpy seas. And of course, you know, you're always a bit sort of nervous if you're not used to it. And I thought, right, okay, I'll get you back. So I got them on stage. Serves them right. Also, the reason I did that was because I wanted them to get a bit of credit for what they do.
Well, now that you're in a fundraiser's position, I guess being a musician in the public eye would help a lot with that.
Yeah, always take a rattly can to gigs. There's a T-shirt that I do. A percentage of that goes direct to the lifeboat. I did a track of West One, Shine On Me by the Ruts, covered it with Paranoid Visions. Every time someone looks at that on whatever it's called, YouTube or something, the money goes directly to the lifeboat. So it's little bits and pieces, yeah. You know, that I'll do just to keep them going and, you know, obviously talk about it and, you know, just promote them.
This song is dedicated to anyone involved in the search and rescue thing who saved lives. So bear with me, will you?
Well, if anybody wants to show their support, you'll find them at seapollinglifeboat.co.uk. I'll also leave a web link in the description for this show in case anybody wants to send any donations or anything like that.
Thank you. It's very kind. Very kind.
Well, since you mentioned Paranoid Visions, I remember a few years back I was playing a gig in Tufnell Park in London at Aces and Eights.
Yeah.
And Paranoid Visions were playing across the road at the Dome. And at the time, an old classmate was a backing singer in Paranoid Visions, so I was going back and forth from both gigs, checking the band out. But you were also in the band, and I wanted to ask you, how did that come about?
How did that come about? I always forget. Peter Jones wrote about it in his autobiography.
Well, didn't they support you on the Last Supper tour at one point?
Yeah, they supported us. They supported us Last Supper. And there was a thing where we were meant to, they were meant to support us in New York. But because our work visas didn't come through quick enough, we had to cancel that gig, but Paranoid Vision still did it. So I said, look, you know, sorry about that. What we'll do, you can support when we do the Last Supper at Shepherd's Bush, you know, and that'll make up for it. So while we're doing that, Pete, after a while, I met Pete, I think at Rebellion or somewhere. And he said, oh, I've got this track, you know, and, you know, I wondered if you could help with the delivery of it because it's Deco wrote it in a way that it's, you know, like Steve Englund machine gun lyrics and he doesn't know how to do it. I said, well, why don't you get me to do it? And went, oh, that'd be great. So, you know, went over to Ireland. I was meant to do two tracks, which ended up being four, of course. And next thing I know, they said, oh, you know, do you want to come on stage and do the track? I went, yeah. And from that, it was like, then he got me when I was in a weak point, a couple of beers, you know, and a bit of adrenaline. Oh, yeah, let's do this again. Me and my big son ended up being in them. So the rest is history.
And in recent years, you also started Slice of Life. I really love those albums. I know you have Carol Hodge in the band, who's an absolute champ. Who else have you got in the group?
Pete Roderson on bass and Pete Wilson on acoustic guitar.
And how was the group formed?
Well, Pete Wilson and Carol were already performing with me when I was doing the Last Supper. And they said to me when we was in Australia, you know, coming home, and they said, what are you going to do after this is all over? And I went, well, I'm thinking of doing a spoken wordy type acoustic-y thing, which I've had in my head for about 20 years. Would you still be interested in doing it? And they went, yeah. So we started. It was very sort of very small and very rickety at the beginning. And we had the original bass player. I wanted a double bass. They had a friend called Lucas, a Spanish guy who had an electric double bass. Because I wanted that sort of jazzy sound. He played with us for a while, but then he got the offer of a really good job in Spain. So I said, mate, you've got to go. You've got to do that, you know.
Yeah.
And fortunately, both Pete and Carol knew Pete Rawlinson, who became the bass player for us, from years ago. So it all just sort of gelled.
Well, obviously, the soundscape of Slice of Life differs from some of the previous bands you've been in, but the content is just as potent. On the album Don't Turn Away, you have a track on there, Your Day Will Come.
Yeah.
Which has a serious bite to it. What are those lyrics responding to?
I was watching TV and there was images of some bastard hitting an elephant with a stick, and the elephant was chained up, so it couldn't go anywhere. And I was like, "You fucking bastard!" And then there was reports in the local papers about people at work in the abattoirs being, you know, kicking and hitting the animals. So I wrote that song about that. And I thought, you know, if anyone ever kicked my dog, I would kick them so hard they wouldn't get up for, you know, a year. So that's what it's about. It's not about people hitting people. And I quite often say this when I'm performing that song at gigs. This, I don't care if people hit each other. they can knock seven shades of whatever out of each other. I don't care. But you don't hit animals. You know, that's wrong. And if you do hit them, then expect to be bitten.
Yeah, and you mentioned that Slice of Life is also kind of not just music, it's spoken word too. And Loving a Lamppost, you have The Homecoming. That's a bit of a standout track for me.
Yeah, that was strange the way that worked out, because I had this bit of writing and it was about, what that's about was when, obviously it's biographical. It's about when I went my stepfather had died, and I went to, you know, obviously see my mum, make sure she was right. And on the way there, I walked around the old streets of my hometown, and it's literally what I was feeling. So that's what it's about. The music, at the time, I was watching a movie a lot called A Taste of Honey, which was made in the 60s with Rita Tushingham. And a lot of the soundtrack to that is English folk song, The Big Ship Sails on the Alley Alley Oo. And that's where the piano music comes from, just going around in there, because that gave a really nice sense of loneliness.
He squinted in the sharp sunlight refracting through the windows of the bus and watched the scenery sliding by. The streets, avenues and roads, all with different names but uniform in appearance. Perhaps some houses gave more of an impression of opulence than others, or the road curved at an obtuse angle, but a stranger wouldn't notice any diversity in the bleakness. The bus ground its way along the busy thoroughfare, stopping for traffic lights and pedestrians, an agonisingly slow progression. He looked at the people around him, tired-looking women with shopping bags, an old man in a flat cap and faded Macintosh, a boy with his arm in a sling, all silent, carried along on a bright autumn day.
And while you're mentioning the piano there, On Your Day Will Come, when the piano solo kicks in, it has a bit of a Bowie, Aladdin Sane kind of vibe, doesn't it?
Yeah, that was deliberate. I said to Carol, yeah, do your Mike Garson bit or whatever it is, you know, just go nuts. There's a record, there's an album by Miles Davis called Kind of Blue, and there's a track on that that will you know, remind you of Your Day Will Come as well, so...
So now that you've mentioned your stepfather and your mother, it might be a good time to jump into your formative years, if that's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So you were born in Stoke-on-Trent, but eventually you were raised by your grandparents in Dagenham?
Yeah, yeah. All I remember, I was born in Stoke-on-Trent, which is in the north of England. My biological father, by all accounts, was an alcoholic and a thief, petty thief. And he got arrested, and that's when my mum just got me and my sister up in the middle of the night one night. I mean, I remember seeing a policeman take my biological father away in handcuffs. And she took us down to Dagenham, and that's where I ended up growing up. And that I would have been two or three at that time. But it's still there in my head, you know, so that's where I grew up, a very, you know, just an industrial suburb of London.
Well, I've heard you use the word sterile before to describe the environment you were in, but it pretty much felt like that until you came across artists such as Toots and the Maytals and David Bowie and people like that.
Yeah, Dagenham was, I mean, Dagenham's London. If you look at a map of London, you know, people say, oh, you know, you sound like a Cockney. I'm not a Cockney. You know, and I don't come from East London. I come from East London, you know, and Dagenham at that time, it was a very comfortable but sterile comfortable, you know, all clipped privet hedges and things. People had moved out from the East End, went to live there because of the Ford factory that was being built. So, you know, they were making sure that the gardens were kept neat. There used to be people from the council come around. If you didn't cut your grass, they'd tell you, you know, if you don't cut your grass, we're going to sort of, you know, blah, blah. It used to be a staunch Labour, you know, area, but it wasn't until, and I, you know, obviously being young and you don't, you know, but I had no sense of identity. Until I saw my first skinhead, you know, I was around a friend's house and he lived next door, you know, and he walked along in his two-tone suit, you know, and his shaven head, put on this amazing music, which was Prince Buster. And I thought, that's what I want to look like. I want to be like that. And that's what started. I suddenly realized there was this thing called identity that I could have, that I didn't have to wear the hand-me-downs that my, you know, the clothes my grandmother. My grandfather would maybe wear so. Like thousands and thousands of other kids in England at the time, I was desperately trying to get money together to buy those clothes.
This is the new town, talk all over town. These independent people are swinging the news around. It's for Jamaica that I stand, so please join my happy band. Let's all together sing this independent song. Cost of living might raise up very high, please, my darling, don't you sit and cry. Just put your shoulders to the wheel, and then we'll have no squeal. Let's all together sing this independent song.
So you're obviously from a very working class background, but was there conservatism in the house?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure if my grandparents had voted, they would have voted Conservative. You know, even though they were very working class, but my grandfather was very much the sort of person, you know, your boss knows better than you, so whatever he says, that goes. You know, that's why I called myself ignorant, because I knew nothing about politics. I knew nothing about unions, believe it or not, because it just, that sort of thing wasn't spoken about in our house. You know, that they knew better than us was what was forced down my throat all the time. So it wasn't until later on, you know, that I started learning about these things.
And then I guess you went to a Clash gig at one point and saw Joe Strummer, and eventually you wanted to start your own punk band.
Yeah, it was when he stood up at the end. Well, he stood there at the end and everyone was throwing things and sort of going, oh, you're crap. And I always remember Joe. He said, you know, well, if you think you can do better, go and start your own effing band. And I thought, yeah, I will. I mean, I'd no idea of how I was going to do it, but that really put it in there. It just lit this spark in me, which I thought had gone forever. I mean, there I was standing here in my trendy. I mean, this time I was working at a hospital in Bristol, in England, this was.
Yeah.
And I remember standing there in my trendy jacket and me jeans, you know, flared jeans with the little turn up, you know, at the bottom. And, you know, the Marcellatio shoes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the haircut, sort of slightly Rod Stewart-y, you know, and there was this thing going on, and I just remember it gripping me, you know, in here. It was like being on terraces at football, for the first time again, you know, and running with the crowd. And I was like, I've got to have this. This is for me. There's no going back. You know, and what I found myself doing was not going to see the well-known bands like The Damned, The Clash and all that. It was going to see other bands like Subway Sect or, you know, I remember a band called Dead Man's Shadow when they appeared, you know, and unknown people. And I found out, you know, I found it a bit more approachable.
So at some point in your early teens, your brother brought you to what became known as Dial House, Penny Rambo.
Yeah.
What was your first experience of there?
Well, I thought they were all raving mad, you know, because I walked in and then, I mean, this bloke came out who later turned out to be Penny Rambo, and he said something and I couldn't understand a blind word he was saying because it sounded like he was using 15 syllables words. And I'm, he had no, you know, no shoes on, you know, bare feet. And I thought, well, ain't you got any indoor slippers, mate? They had no telly. They had stones inside the house. You know, they didn't eat meat. They had no curtains. It's like no carpets. I'm like, what's going on here? But the more I got to know them, the more I sort of got into it, you know, and what I really liked about them was that they always encouraged and, you know, me to do things, to be creative, because at that time I was trying to write poetry. And all of the people that went there at that time would, you know, I must have been, how old was I, 13, 12, 13. So I didn't really know what I was talking about, but they would always listen to what I was saying, you know, and that's the first time that adult people older than me had actually listened to what I had to say.
That's a pretty amazing experience to have had that young.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned you were writing poetry at the time. Were there any writers who stood out to you back then?
Well, no, because what the sort of poetry I was writing was that lali 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 la lali lali la rhyme lali 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 la lali lali la rhyme, and it wasn't until Dick LeBeau, a guy called Dick LeBeau, said, you know, that's fine. But look, there's this American poet called Walt Whitman. Try reading that. And of course, it's all, Walt Whitman's writing a lot about the Civil War, the American Civil War. So as a young man, I found it interesting. And then I really liked the way that it wasn't necessarily rhyming. Dylan Thomas I found a bit hard to get on with. But then I was introduced to a book by Hubert Selby Jr. called Last Exit to Brooklyn, which showed a different way of writing prose. And from all those influences, I sort of started writing different.
I had to give him I had to dignify his life in some way. And I mean dignify, not romanticize. And so I finished his story, and as I was doing that, the concept for the book developed. So in a very real way, Georgie was responsible for my writing Last Exit to Brooklyn.
I want to ask you, your nickname is Cubby.
Correct.
How did you get the name?
Well, I'm not sure, but when you have a name like Hubert, and you're playing on the streets of Brooklyn with Vinny and Mikey and Tony, and they look at you, Hubert, you know, you have to do something to survive. And maybe the only reason I survived my childhood was eventually I got to be called Cubby instead of Hubert.
So you dropped out of school when you were 15 and you went to work on the waterfront. Why did you drop out?
I was as restless, irritable, and discontent. I couldn't stand it. I just couldn't stand it. And I also knew I could never succeed in school. It terrified me. I couldn't do it. I had to go. I had to go.
Well, I guess you came to the house more or less as an angry kid looking for release, but they encouraged you to articulate yourself.
Yeah, and to read books that, you know, I mean, that was the great thing, because if I would go there and stay for a weekend, all I'd do is read books, maybe. You know, go for a walk now and again. But no one told me off. No one said I was being lazy. You know, whereas if I did that at home, you know, what are you doing? Well, I'm reading a book. Well, come down here and read it. Well, you've got the telly on, so I can't. Well, what? It's like, oh, what are you reading anyway? Oh, poetry. Well, you're a poof. You know, my stepdad's words. You know, that kind of thing. Oh, you're listening to Deli Bowie again. Oh, that big girl's, you know. So I just wanted away from that. I was just like, I knew that I didn't want to be around those people. Well, I didn't know how I was going to get out, but one day I was going to get out, and I did. It was just stifling, you know, it was just suffocating. And because of the way they were, it just built up, you know, I got so resentful. I remember being very bitter for a while, you know, and I think that's where, you know, probably the venom came out of football and that kind of thing, you know, for a lot of young men and young women as well. I mean, yeah.
Well, you touched on why you initially called yourself Steve Ignorant. Would those elements have been in that name too?
Yeah, but I mean, really, it was because politics. Look, my stepfather and my mother, I mean, my grandfather and grandmother had died by this time. So it was just me and my stepfather and me mum. Mm. And whatever it was that came on TV, if it was, you know, I remember going around once and it was the miner strike, Orgreave, you know, when the police steamed in and gave that bloke, you know, brain damage. And what did my stepdad say? Go on, get in there, bleeding miners, always wanting more money. So it's that kind of stuff, you know. So previous to that, obviously, no politics was spoken about. You know, you went to work, you were a man, you didn't cry. If you're a man, you don't write poetry, you go out, you do your work, you get paid, that's it.
Well, in this fast-changing world, even with me and the culture I come from, I often find that I'm forced to re-examine things and to a point, kind of unlearn certain things as well. Was that how it was for you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, or it was not necessarily unlearn things, but it was like finding different things to do. And, you know, it's when I started work myself and I was working at a supermarket and I got in with some lads who were into West Ham at the time, so I found that football thing. And then, of course, there was these things called mopeds. The FS1A Yamaha, which I got. So there was that influence. So that got me away. And then after that, there was these things called girls. And then after that, there was this thing called alcohol. And you put all these things together and it was like, this is brilliant. Actually, I'm quite enjoying this. but you always want a bit more, don't you? You know, it's, you get to that point where it's like, well, this is getting a bit sort of same old.
Yeah.
And that's when I moved out and went to Bristol, you know, just to try something else.
So eventually you become a resident of Dial House, and when you want to start up a punk band, Penny Rambeau offers to play drums. So essentially, Crass in the beginning was a duo of just drums and vocals.
That was the beginning, yeah. And I said, you know, what about guitars and things? And he went, oh no, it would just be drums and vocals. I went, are you sure? He went, yeah, but who else is doing it? I mean, oh, fair point, you know, all right. But then, of course, bit by bit, other people joined. You know, Steve Urban, the original guitarist, joined. But he had to go because he was too, a bit like Burt Whedon, meets the Sex Pistols. Mm. You know, plunk, 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 the plunk. The sound weren't right and all that sort of thing. Pete Wright joined. He was, the bass player. He was pretty good. We got rid of Steve Urban and we got Phil Free in, who was a bit more raunchy, had a better guitar, and Andy Palmer. You know, he couldn't play guitar at all, so he just tuned his guitar to an open chord. And that's why he played like that all the time. And, I know, and Andy Palmer, to this day, still can't play a guitar. That's a pretty mean achievement. So,
1, 2, 3, 4.
I like Remedy Ma, brought up blow. Used to call me Swifty, I like what is blithy. Now that I'm different, you'd love the best way. You'd love to see me jobber, love to see me gay. Do they owe us a living? Cause I do, cause I do, owe us a living. Cause I do, cause I do, owe us a living. Cause I fucking do.
fucking know!
So with Dial House, did Penny have an ideal to start an open house movement?
Yeah, oh, that was before my time. I mean, you know, I think his idea was hopefully him and other people would set up a network of Dial Houses all over England so that you could travel from one to the other and stay the night. And the deal being that if you were a cook, you know, if you were a chef, you cooked a meal and that was your rent for the night. Or if you were a poet, you spoke your poetry. Or if you were a guitarist, you played guitar. If you were a gardener, kind of thing, you know, so it's like built on a barter system.
Yeah.
And I think that was always his dream. But unfortunately, it never came to pass because it obviously, you know, people take advantage or you get the people who will abuse that. And a lot of people who tried to set up, not a commune, but a community household. I mean, that's the strange thing that always happened, that people often ask me, you know, Steve, how did it work at Dial House? And for some reason, it worked. You know, there was never a rota written on the wall, Thursday, Steve washes up. Friday, Steve cooks. You know, it was like, okay, if there's washing up in the sink, you do it. If anyone else cooking tonight, no, all right, I'll do it then. You know, it sort of worked out that way, and it was all about consideration for the other people. That worked for us. Unfortunately, other people who tried it, it didn't quite work, certainly in the inner cities. You know, obviously you've got more drugs and alcohol to deal with there. And
sure, yeah.
You know. I remember having a long conversation with Penn and saying, look, Penn, not everybody can live like we do, yeah. You know, and it, you know, we've got to be careful what we say because, you know, how can we expect people to grow their own vegetables on a high rise, you know, flat in Bolton? But we always try to put across, you know, this idea of, I don't know, we know we've got this, but we're just trying to put this across, you know, and hopefully we weren't being too snooty about it, if you know what I mean.
When people heard the message that Crass had within their songs, did they come to Dial House to take a closer look at things?
Yeah, and I mean, the nice thing was that what happened was before Dial House had always been a bit, and I have to say this, there weren't many working class people visiting it until I turned up. But once Crass had started, it became more working class people coming. And then they would go away with this idea in their head and try and set up their own sort of thing. So, you know, hopefully it works in that way.
Well, you touched on an important thing there. With you and Penny being from very different backgrounds, you kind of smashed that class divide by forming a duo in the first place.
Yeah, the thing with me and Penny is that once we start, I think for Penny it was a way of him shocking people that used to visit there. And for me it was learning from him a bit more about the politics, you know, what is anarchism? You know, I mean, I remember I made the fatal mistake of asking Penny Rambo, you know, Pen, what is existentialism? You know, cause I just don't understand it. And he said, Steve, it's rather like the M25. And the M25 is a road that goes all around London, you know, to sort of get rid of it. And I'm like, okay, fair enough. And I still don't know what it is. I mean, it seems pretty miserable to me, whatever it is, but
I'm
And the first Crass gig was at a Squatters Festival on Huntley Street in London.
Yeah, that Huntley Street is a street. It's still there. It runs parallel with Tottenham Court Road in London. Mm. And one half of the street was all squats, and the other half was all rent paying, you know, gentry. And we knew one of the people who lived there. I went back there recently to Huntley Street, and just to see if it was still there. And it was. The squat I used to stay in, you know, is now a business. It's all been gentrified. You know, there's push buttons on the OM gates now. You can't get in. And where the gig actually, our first gig actually took place was in a play area, like a playground. Mm. I think that's still there, but you can't get to it because it's locked. But I'd love to go back. I'm once this bloody thing opens up, I'm hoping to go down to London, you know, and talk to someone in that office block and say, look, it was the possibility, you know, I used to be in a band and my first gig was in the playground. Is it all right if the security guard comes with me and I just have to take a photograph of where it was, you know?
Yeah.
Because I'd really like to do that.
Yeah, that'd be pretty special.
Yeah, unfortunately, things being what they were, Huntley Street got all the squats got turfed out. I mean, it's in all the papers, you know, they sent the diggers in and everything, you know. I mean, I don't know what happened to those people. I know Martin Lee, who was our friend who organised that first Crass gig. He went to a housing co-op in King's Cross, but I don't know what happened to him after that. I'd love to see him again.
They said that we were trash. Well, the name is Crass, not Clash. They can stuff their punk credentials. It's them that take the cash. They won't charge enough for their festival talk. RAR badges and their protest wall. Bands of white men standing in a park. Objected to ISIS, declared in the dark. Black man's got his problems, he's right to deal with it. Tonight, for yourself, you're up with your white liberal shit. If you care to take a close look at the way things really stand, you'll see we're all just niggers to the rulers of this land. Punk was once an answer to 2 years of crap. A way of saying no, we'd always said yep. The moment we saw a way to be free, they invented a dividing line through credibility. The qualifying factors are politics and class. Lefty match our team fighters with the cars. I said for the racism, I came on the street. It was out the form of fashion for the social elite. Bigotry and blindness, a Marxist god. Another clever trick to keep us all in line. Neat little labels to keep us all apart. Keep us all divided when the troubles start.
Well, I guess bands like The Clash and The Pistols inspired you to be in a punk band, but for different reasons. Originally just to be in a punk band, but eventually you were more inspired to do it differently than how they did it.
Yeah, and I could see where it was going, you know. You know, I knew that once the Sex Pistols went to America, they wouldn't come back. You know, and that seemed to happen a lot with bands. You know, they went to America and they came back like rock and roll bands, just like any other band. Mm. And that happened to The Clash as well, unfortunately. Although I still play their records now, you know. I still think they are, you know, a great band. But it's just the way it was. You know, look at Billy Idol. You know, he went there and never came back. And I thought that was such a shame, really. And we thought, like, we will do it different. We won't play at big venues like they're all doing. We'll play, small venues. We'll do it word of mouth. So that's why we end up playing in little cricket huts, scout halls, and things like that, well off the beaten track, at 50p to get in, you know. We found that it was people that our audiences were made up of, people who couldn't afford to go down to London. So we'd end up playing in places like Cumbria, you know, where nobody ever went to. But thanks to us and a few other bands that were around at the time, Flux, Pinginions, Conflict, Subhumans, a whole network built up around those places. So you had this network which was separate from the establishment, and the proper punks, if I can say that, we'd set up our own little network, and that still exists to today, you know, including bands like Chumbawamba, you know, who came through that network.
It's a lie in your business everywhere. It's a lie when they say they'll never persecute you. Innocent before guilty. It's a lie you will get used to. The right to free speech is another misconception. They'll make sure that no one tells of their continual deception. They'll arrest, detain and exile, torture and discriminate, and lie to you when they say it's you they really care about. It's a lie when they say your vote means that you're being heard. Time you stop crossing boxes. They run these lies and try to hide them. I told the truth, but not to inside.
With Crass being an art collective, a movement, and all these other things, as well as being a punk band, we're only going to be able to scratch the surface on this call, but could you give us a general sense of what a Crass gig would have looked like?
We didn't set out for it to be a movement. That just happened, you know, honestly. What we decided was, just because we're a punk band, we didn't have a lot of money. Okay, we ain't got a lot of money, but there's no reason why we can't make it look as good as anything else. So what we did was we got a lot of black paint and we painted all of the equipment we had black. There's this material called scrim. We just covered all the speakers in that. So if it was sprayed the crescent on it. Went out and we decided that we would present a real onslaught. We knew that out of fear and nervousness that we were playing 100 miles an hour so people couldn't always understand the words. So we used to hand out lyric sheets. But also we'd have Mick Duffield would be showing a film while we were playing. Also on either side of the stage we'd have TVs, four TVs, two of which were playing a loop, like a video loop, and the other two were showing whatever was on TV that night. So if people didn't remember the words or anything, maybe in 20 years' time they'd remember an image from that movie, or maybe they'd remember something. So it was like a thing. That's why we worked with that, you know. I mean, I never got to see it because I was always on stage. But apparently, by all accounts, it was a pretty amazing thing to see.
So it was more or less a multimedia experience with a lot of information.
Yeah, and we always handed out, you know, leaflets, what to do if you're arrested. You know, certainly in this country, if you ain't got a lot of money, here's how you can make a loaf of bread, you know, flour and water, you know, don't worry if it turns out stodgy, you can still eat it. We tried to do things as cheaply as possible. My idea with that, keep the price down. Because if someone's only got a fiver and it costs them, you know, 50p or a pound to get into our gig, they've still got £4 to buy a packet of fags and a couple of beers. And that's why I always looked at it. Keep the price down, so then, because I know what it's like to have no money. You know, I do know what it's like to go through the ashtray and unravel cigarettes and re-roll them. So,
I'm a little man, and it's
And I guess he's encouraged positive action for people to take responsibility for their own lives and advocated such things as feminism, environmentalism, anti-fascism, and just encouraged a DIY approach in general.
Yeah, and we always found it a bit weird that, well, not weird, but, you know that the ratio between men and women at punk gigs was 70-30.
Yeah.
You know, well, that's to us seemed silly, you know, so that's when, you know, through Penis Envy, that album that we did that I wasn't on. And then what we found because of Penis Envy and because people, men and women, were talking to Eve Libertine and Joy DeVive and the women in the band, was that young punks were going away, and they would get starting. You'd see more bands with female vocalists, which was a great thing. Or you'd get young male punks trying to write non-sexist lyrics, failing miserably, of course, like you do when you first start. You know, we all do. But it was a start, and at least they were thinking about it, you know. And look at bands like Hey Guard of Womb. You know, I mean, you know, I saw Ruth a few weeks ago. I went, blimey, Ruth, how old was you when you was going out, you know, with, and she went, I was 14. I was like, get out. And 14 years old, singing about women's issues and things and getting beaten up for it, you know. Anyway, yeah, so all of that, I think the way we saw ourselves was like an information bureau because there was no social media at that time. There was no internet or anything. So on the back of records, we'd always have addresses that you could write to if you needed information on stuff. And people did. And other bands started picking up on that as well.
Well, how Crass executed most things seems to have been the stepping stone that a lot of other bands took their lead from.
Yeah, well, I'm proud of that. You know, I'm proud that, I don't like to say we were an influence, but, you know, I'm proud to have been part of that band that was such an inspiration to people. And, you know, and as much as I'm grateful for people like David Bowie and certain authors and filmmakers for that inspiration they've given me to write, you know, I always find it very humbling, you know, and I'm proud to be a part of it.
Well, music changes people's lives, but Crass and yourself, you've literally changed culture.
I don't think any of us realised that because we didn't. Obviously, we was in Crass, but to us, we was in a band. You know, we didn't see the effect we were having. And in fact, it wasn't until, this is going to sound strange, but maybe until about 20, 25 years ago when Yona got her first computer and I just typed in Steve Eggman to see what, and whoa, all this stuff came up. And I was like, blimey, I'm famous, you know. And it's because, I think, because of the rise of social media. Also because there's been sort of other new generations coming through, that there's been a resurgence of interest. And plus with just what crap has been going on in this world, you know, that it's all, I don't think it's ever going to go away, you know. And I mean, the thing is that what I find amazing, whether or not the other ex-members of Crass like it or not, but whatever we did, whether it was the music, the lyrics, whether it was the artwork, whether it's the gigs, that band, Crass, has touched people all over the world very deeply and emotionally, unlike any other band has done. And I just find that really strange. Mm. You know, so...
Well, you mentioned the Crass album Penis Envy there earlier on, and before that you had a couple of classics too. You had Stations of the Crass.
But then there was a bit, remember, there was a pretty dodgy album that came out as well, you know, 10 Notes and a Bloody Summer's Day, and that, you know, please don't buy it because it's not worth the vinyl it's bloody pressed on. It's the only good thing for that is to make an ashtray out of it.
Well, with your debut album, The Feeding of the 5,000, I mean, between the opening tracks, Asylum and Do They Owe Us a Living, it's an incredible debut recording for a band, but I believe you had some pressing issues with that album. Did the pressing plant want to censor Asylum, and did they take the track out?
No, we took Asylum out because what happened was the pressing plant was actually not in, I think it was in Southern Ireland. And the people at the pressing plant went, well, we're going on strike if we're not doing that. So we took it off. We just left the length of time. It would have been called a sound free speech. Mm. And then later on, re-released it as a single and did it. How much were we selling it for? 50 pence, I think. And of course, being sort of young and naive, we didn't realise there was this thing called 45p we were selling it for. And... we didn't realise there was this thing called VAT. So every time we sold a single, we were losing money. We soon learnt anyway, still.
Down now from your cross, down now from your papal heights, from that churlish suicide, petulant child. Down from those pious heights, royal flag bearer, goat, Billy, I vomit for you. Forgive, shit he forgives. He hangs in crucified delight, nailed to the extent of his vision, his cross, his manhood, violence, guilt, sin. He would nail my body upon his cross, suicide visionary, death reveller, rape.
And in response to the difficulties that you've had in releasing the record and with having to leave Asylum off there, Crass went on to form their own record label, but you didn't just release your own music, you also released music for friends and other bands as well.
Yeah, we started getting visits from the police and we didn't, because we were still on Small Wonder at that time, and we didn't want Pete Stennett to get into trouble, you know, a little independent record store. So we borrowed some money and started up our own record label, so that if anyone was going to be done, it was going to be us. Mm. And then, as much as we could, we helped other bands to, you know, do you want to do a record? Yeah, do it on this. Then we started another label called Corpus Christi, which was for bands. It wouldn't quite fit on a Crass label, but it would fit on Corpus Christi, so we could still sort of help them out, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
But again, you know, other bands took up the bent, you know, up that torch, and look at, you know, Subhuman started Blurg, mm-hmm. Conflict started Mortar Hate, you know, lots of little independent labels started, and it was just absolutely brilliant. You know, just absolutely fantastic. Everyone having a go. And for a time, we were giving that music industry, you know, that awful business that everyone knows, you know, we were giving it a right run for its money.
It must have felt quite threatening to the music business.
Yeah, of course it was, you know, but they deserve it. They shouldn't be so horrible. And give those artists the money they deserve, you sods.
Bye.
So you took your time when recording Christ the album, and then you had the quick response of Yes Sir I Will in the experimental way that you recorded it. But in between, Crass had doctored up a tape of a conversation between Thatcher and Reagan.
Yeah.
Which I believe caused quite a stir.
Yeah, and, yeah, a member of Crass went to my hand. Literally, it was a cassette tape. And he literally taped from the little transistor radio a speech by Reagan and a speech by Thatcher. And then literally what he got a razor blade and just cut the tape and stuck it together. Sent it abroad to somewhere. Sent it to Europe. And we didn't hear anything for ages. And then a little thing appeared in the Washington Post about a possible KGB hoax, you know, about Thatcher and Reagan. And then the next thing, you know, the Observer newspaper was ringing us up saying, it's you, isn't it? And we're like, what's us? He went, you know, it's, and we said, why didn't you come over a cup of tea and we'll talk about it? And that's when we let it out, you know, and it was us.
A British punk rock group is claiming they're behind a fake tape recording which fooled the CIA. The American intelligence agency thought it was part of a Soviet disinformation plan. Here's Andrew Parkinson.
The genuine voices of Mrs. Thatcher and President Reagan. Through the crackles, he seems to be saying he'd fire missiles at his allies to keep the Soviets back behind their borders during a war. You mean Germany, Mrs. Thatcher incredulously replies. But it's all a fake made by punk rock group Crass. Band member Andy Palmer.
We cut up two speeches, one of Reagan and one of Thatcher, sent the tape anonymously to the continent with a covering note saying that it was a recording of a crossed line.
The tape came into the hands of the CIA, who studied it, and then issued a statement saying it was part of an increasingly sophisticated Russian disinformation campaign. Now the CIA is clearly embarrassed by its mistake, but why did Crass do it?
People know that governments are corrupt. People know that governments are violent. We did the tape to show that they're also small-minded, petty and stupid. For the CIA to issue that statement shows just how petty they are.
Now the group's touring the States, giving interviews about how easily they fooled the West's largest intelligence network.
Because of that, we were on the CIA files, and I know for sure that Crass were, all of us were investigated by MI5. That was released when Margaret Thatcher's personal papers were released publicly. It was there, and not only Crass, but bands like the Bella Ballet were being investigated by the MI5, so yeah.
But it was creative and kind of dangerous too.
Yeah, but I mean, to us, it was like, we didn't think anyone was going to take it serious because it was so badly done, deliberately. We didn't think anyone would take it seriously at all. They did. You know, it's like, what the fuck's up here? You know, I mean, at one point we had to do this interview. You had to go down and interview. Yeah, the KGB was sniffing around. There was this day we had to do an interview with an American newspaper and a Russian newspaper in the same hotel, but in different rooms. Mm-hmm. So we were going from one room to the other. Well, the Russians had vodka, of course, so I was spending a lot of time with them. And in the end, we went, look, this is stupid. Why don't we all just sit in the same room? And, of course, everyone did. And in the end, I got bored. I went down the pub. But then the Americans and the Russians were talking, so there weren't really. But it was just, you know, it was that ridiculous.
It sounds like Monty Python or something like that, like a classic British comedy sketch.
You couldn't write it. I mean, it was just silly, you know, just silly.
You're listening to LBC Reports. It's 13 minutes to 4, and no doubt you've been hearing in the news today or during the course of LBC programmes that the Attorney General has been asked to prosecute an anti-Falklands war record under the Obscene Publications Act. Here's a sample. Well, Conservative MP for Enfield North, Tim Egger, says...
It starts off, the last song starts off with the words, "You shithead, slimy, got it all." And then it gets worse from there.
All right, you dirty horrible lot, get your bleeding air cut!
No, sir, I won't.
If there was no government, wouldn't there be chaos? Everybody running round, setting petrol pumps off. And if there was no police force, tell me what you'd do. If Bertie Feather's rioters came running up the ass, and they would clean the cellars, who'd mend my silly dishes? Wouldn't people lay around without substance permission? Who'd drive the fire engines, who'd fix
Well, you named the band Crass after the David Bowie lyric, but for a time you contemplated Stormtrooper.
Oh, Christ, yeah. The reason I thought of that was because, of a film, a black and white film called Life at the Top. And there's a bit where two men are in a strip club in London, and the guy on the stage goes, "And direct from Hamburg, Miss Stormy Trooper. And on she comes in jack boots and a leather coat, you know, and sort of blonde hair. And that's my thinking, but good job he didn't go for it. But then Penn's idea was, Les Enfants Terribles. I was like, yeah, I can just see that on a T-shirt. Yeah, it's a piece off. So now it's Crass.
Still a lot of legal loopholes to be plugged. On the other hand, if the solicitors would pull their fingers out, so to speak, the contract could be finished in a week. Isn't it nice? Oh, yes. I mean, the way we do business here.
And the Crass logo for the band is an iconic one. Who designed that?
That was a guy called Dave King. He's got a book out. I'd advise people to, I think it's called The Crass. Yeah, The Origins of the Crass Symbol. There's also a bit where he's talking online about it. And there's a YouTube thing you can check out, Dave King. Please, people, do watch it. Unfortunately, Dave King died a couple of years ago. But briefly, to let people know as much as I do, Penn asked him to design something for a bit of writing he was doing called Christ Reality Asylum, which was going to be like a little leaflety book thing. It wasn't a song at that time or a bit of music. And Dave King at that time was very much into samurai symbolism from, you know, the Edo era or whatever in Japan, you know, like the clans. And a lot of the symbols were usually in a circle. And very much based around flowers or, you know, chrysanthemums. So Dave King's idea was to make it look as much as possible like a samurai clan symbol, incorporating the Union flag and also the two serpents. And I'll just leave it like that because I think it's better if people go, you know, get on the Dave King thing and find out for themselves. So
I sort of fashioned it so that one part would touch another part, so you could make it into a stencil. And we sprayed all the copies. We produced 50 copies of this publication, and then the band was just starting to form as I was leaving the house, and they adopted the symbol from this publication for the band.
Offices, your student system and skills. See, I've got nothing better to do than to grovel in a shame and crap. Ask for the bread and homeless, wide awake, a pat on the back.
So just to finish out on the Crass timeline, it pretty much started around 77 and finished in 84. But it came to an end, at least in terms of playing live on the way back from a gig in Wales. Is that right?
Yeah, it was a place called Aberdare, and it was a benefit for the miners. The miners' strike was on that time. And we were driving back, and sort of 20 minutes down the road, Andy Palmer suddenly went, I want to leave the band. And there was me, and I think someone else went, don't, Andy, you know. I think it was me or Eve Libertine, another half hour down the road. I remember saying to him, do you know what? Yeah, if it hadn't been you, Andy, saying, I think it would have been me. And it, by the time he got back, it was like, should we carry on without him? You know, what should we do? And it's like, no, that's it. You know, it felt right. There's been a lot of speculation, you know, the countdown, you know, on our records used to have 521984. And I've seen Penny Rambo do an interview where he says it was designed to end in 1984. No, it bloody well wasn't, because I remember having a conversation with Penny Rambo. I said, Penny, you know, we're doing this sort of like 721984. He said, yeah. I said, what happens when it gets to 1984 and we're still going? Do we do minus or something? He said, oh, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. So we weren't planning to finish in 1984. That's another myth. Penny Rambo was started. So
obviously, George Orwell's book was tied in there as well.
Well, of course, yeah.
A Northern Ireland minister was asked if he believed the army was to blame.
I very much regret, as I'm sure everybody does, the deaths of the two teenagers in Londonderry last night. It has to be said that some 250 people get killed on the roads in this province every year. And of course, when a riot takes place, there's much more risk of a road accident than at any other time.
And then, you know, there are some terrible cruelties and personal tragedies in life. And every day I look in the papers and read them, I know the agony they are going through. And Mark knows too.
I love the dynamic of the relationship between yourself and Penny. You seem to keep each other on your toes.
Yeah, well, I take the mickey out of him and he takes the mickey out of me. So, once this is over, we feel comfortable going out. Me and Penny, I will do a question and a Q&A thing.
That'd be brilliant.
People really like it. We'll get it filmed, you know, so we can put it on here. Mm. But it's when me and him get together, it's like Laurel and Hardy, you know, or something like that, you know. We just ping off each other. Yeah. It's great. It's great fun.
Did you find that a lot? Did you find that there was kind of a price to pay for all the responsibility of everything that you stood for?
I think the price we paid was that towards the end, we became very bitter people. Mm. It had been 7 years of nonstop, you know, and it just really, honestly, it didn't stop. Mm. And every image we looked at, you know, was dark and dismal and depressing. And I think we were starting to snipe at each other. And I think for me, when Crass finished, it was a good thing. Because I remember that day when I was still wearing black, although I do now, still wearing black. I was on top of the bus and I remember seeing these punks posing for having their photograph taken, the tourists in King's Road in London. Mm. And I thought, I don't want to look like this anymore. And I would colour. And I remember getting off the bus and I went to a second-hand shop, like a retro shop I knew, down there in Battersea. And I bought a bowling shirt, I think, a pair of Brothel Creepers and a pair of Rockabilly trousers. Combed me hair, you know, just did it in a side parting. And for the first time, it felt really weird to be wearing colour again. But it felt so refreshing. Mm. I started listening to Motown again. I started listening to things like Nina Simone, you know, Dionne Warwick. Started listening, you know, started watching films again that weren't depressing. Mm. It was brilliant. I could, you know, I started going down the pub and I could look at the barmaid's backside without being called sexist, you know. It was fantastic, you know, but I wouldn't have missed it for the world.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel.
Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me.
Well, after Crass had finished up, you wrote and recorded a song called Take Your Elbows Off the Table. What inspired that one?
I'd read a book called Bury My Heart, Wounded Knee. Mm. And also a book by a Native American called Black Elk. And it just really moved me. And that inspired me to write a song, you know. And Take Your Elbows Off the Table was something I was always told. By my grandparents, you didn't put your elbows on something you were eating. It was rude. Mm. And I remember reading that there was a Native American, I think he was called Chief Joseph from the Nez Perce tribe.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, you think you've trained us, you've civilized us because we don't know how to use a toilet and this kind of thing, mm. you know, but we have our own civilization. And that really struck me as well. So that's where the song came from. And then I had a friend called Ian Asprey, who was in a band called Southern Death Cult at the time. Later it was to become Death Cult and then the Cult. Ian put me in touch with a Native American guy up there in upstate New York, who I went to visit. And the idea was that I'd release Take Your Elbows Off the Table as a 12-inch sort of rap thing, and all the proceeds would go to whatever cause they wanted it to go to. So it was going to go to a newspaper they were doing, strictly about, you know, and for Native Americans. But when it, in the end, it never got released, you know, and people have said to me, why don't you release it? I never really liked it. It never really did. When I went in the studio and I got Penny Rambo to produce it, and I'm not dissing Penn or anything, but as usual, it became a Penny Rambo production and it wasn't what I wanted. It doesn't work for me, so that's why it won't be released. I did versions of it with Schwarzenegger and also Stratford Mercenaries. So I performed it.
Well, you've obviously seen a lot of Punch and Judy shows throughout your life, but eventually you became Professor Ignorant and carried out the tradition yourself for a while.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, that was when Crass finished, and I was like, well, it was quite a few years after Crass finished, and I was like, what should I do now? I know, I'll do the classic thing that everybody does, and I'll do my own acoustic album. You know, what should I write on? And at that time, I was reading a lot about Jack the Ripper and Freemasonry. And I thought, oh, I'll do an album about Jack the Ripper. Well, thank God, someone showed me a film called This Is Spinal Tap, because otherwise I would have been that idiot who would have done that. So I thought, right, I ain't doing that. What used to scare me as a child, and that was Punch and Judy, used to disturb me. So I started looking into it. started researching it, into it. And I thought, well, I'll write a radio play based around it. And to give myself inspiration, I carved a Mr. Punch figure out of wood. And I thought, well, there's a lot of kids coming to visit Darway House at that time. And I thought, well, I'll make a set of puppets for them and they can sort of play with them. And I thought, well, I might as well make the tent for them as well, you know, the booth. And once I'd done it, I thought, well, I might as well have a go at doing it. So I did it and got on pretty well with it. And, yeah, became I did become pretty good at it. So I did that for quite a while. Ended up working through an agency, an entertainment agency, but I left that because I didn't enjoy it very much. I didn't like going to people's houses and entertaining their children. I much preferred just turning up on a street corner and doing it there.
But you are pretty particular in staying true to its traditions in a modern world of political correctness?
As much as possible, yeah. And I mean, the thing is that, people will take offence. What you have to remember is that it's a window into British history, and some of it isn't very pleasant.
Yeah.
There's lots of characters that have been and gone that wouldn't work, but it's gone so far. You can't have the hanging scene, apparently, I've heard. Punch can't hit the crocodile because he's being cruel to animals, so where's it going to stop? What are you going to end up with? Mr. Punch goes Betty buys. he was the original working class hero. And the punch, what I think what people don't realise is that the Punch show, because it wasn't always Punch and Judy, the Punch show was designed for adults. It wasn't until Victorian times when the rich wanted that entertainment in their houses. So you can blame them for it.
But you touched on it there. You also handcrafted your own puppets for it too.
It's traditional to do that. And I always encourage people when I, I'm no good at that. Doesn't matter. It was always traditional no matter how rough. It's just that you've put that in there yourself. And it's lovely. I always found it lovely to see people's homemade ones. I mean, it's lovely to see the ones that are made by Punch craftsmen or craftswomen. But they can look a bit sort of similar. But it's when you see the real individual ones and rough and ready. And I love that. I always loved it, and speaking from experience, you can get two paper bags and just draw faces on them and you can just do that. And you will entertain an audience.
Now the show is very nearly over. How we hate to see them. All the figures come back for the finish, see the maker gracious men. Of all the things that tickled every fancy in the days of long ago, there were none that made us quite so happy as the Punch and Judy show.
You mentioned a couple of your later projects there. You were also in Conflict, and you've done some work with David Tibet of Current 93.
Yeah.
I recently saw some footage of you in the 100 Club. I mean, that just seems so intense.
Yeah, it was very strange, and I don't really know why. I think at that point I was sort of trying anything. And I liked David Tibet anyway. He was a really good friend of mine. And he said, I'd written this thing called Falling Back in Fields of Rape on one of his albums. And he said, well, how about doing it live? And so we started doing little bits and pieces live.
Yeah,
did a few things with him. But in the end, I had to sort of leave that because I just didn't feel comfortable doing it anymore. And plus, I went to a gig with him once and there was these fucking idiots there, all dressed up like SS blokes, I nearly sort of tore their heads off. So I thought I'd better sort of leave it.
No mark on your spotless conscience. No blemish on your immaculate body. Untouched by sight or sound of misery. Close the eyes. Shift the responsibility. It was not you. It was not you. Falling back in fields of rape.
Yeah, it's an incredible experience of life. I mean, you've always kind of seemed to have reacted to things and evolved and just liberated yourself in whatever way you could.
Yeah, and like with people say, oh, Steve, what's the slice of life deal? And it's, well, what I'm trying to do, I wanted to simplify it all, so that if someone came along to a slice of life gig and thought to themselves, oh, I could do that. Yeah, you could, please do. And also what I'm trying to, as a carry-on from the Crass thing, I'm trying to address the aging process that I'm going through. I've lived longer than I'm going to. I've got all wrinkles. I've got funny things that happen in my body now that never used to. I've got hairs growing where they shouldn't. I'm forgetting things. I'm wearing glasses. You know, it's got to be addressed. So that's what I'm trying to approach with it, you know.
Ignore the mirror, close my eyes again. Another yawn and I'll be guilty free. I should be fighting for a cause, should be fighting one or was. But disillusionment has come creeping spent within its claws. And where's that spark I had? Did I flush it down the lab? Every mouthful made me glad, every swallow so sublime. All the ideals in my mind unravel and unwind as I feel my own mortality. These wrinkles are reality, and somewhere in the darkness I see a slice. Three reasons to live, three reasons to think twice. I trail my clouds of misery, someone dried these eyes for me. Oh, let those bells ring out for me.
I've been following your social media there, and I've seen you've been rescheduling some dates to perform crass songs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And who's going to be in the band doing that?
That's going to be me, Pete Wilson, lead guitar, Carol Hodge on keyboards and vocals, Pete Rowe on bass, and Jay Bagnall, who also performs with Paranoid Visions on drums.
Well, I said it to you at the start that you're always very generous with your time, and thanks for remaining accessible. It's an absolute credit to your character, and thanks to Yona too for the communication. I hope we can all get to see you live on stage again soon.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, I don't know when we'll be coming to the States. I don't know when that's going to open up. I mean, it is, I'm sure you know, for bands to come there, you know, what with the work permits and all that, it's so expensive. But we'll be there at some point.
Well, again, thanks for your time, and enjoy your beer. You deserve it.
Yeah, pleasure, mate. Listen, thanks, and keep in touch, yeah?
I will do, Steve.
Smash in. Okay, mate. I'll catch you later, yeah? See you later, Dylan. See you
to my touch, your body won't get me. 1, 2, 3, 4. Start to control, like.